Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henward, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests today. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Gilbert Ashkar, who'll tell us what's been going on in Egypt lately. And then we'll hear from a frequent Behind the News guest, Adolf Reed, who'll talk mostly about the emergence of a new generation of black politicians, mostly post-civil rights neoliberals, and a little bit about how poverty came to dominate American discourse about inequality. No time even for a few words in the news today, so straight to the first interview. Gilbert Ashkar is a professor of development studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the University of London. His latest book is The People Want, A Radical Exploration of the Arab Uprising. Here he is to answer a few questions about what's been happening in Egypt. Gilbert Ashkar. We've seen just the most amazing display of events in Egypt over the last few weeks, the largest demonstration in human history, some people are calling it, followed by a coup and now a lot of chaos. What is your reading of what is happening?
Well, I think you characterized the events correctly. That is, you had an absolutely fascinating, a huge mass mobilization, even relatively to the population of the country. And on the other hand, a coup. And actually, some people get into discussions on whether, well, this was a revolutionary movement or a coup. And the truth is that it's both. And it is not original in that regard. Because what happened in February 2011 was exactly the same combination of a huge mass mobilization that, at that time against the previous president, Mubarak, and a coup which removed Mubarak on the 11th of February and led to the direct rule of the country for several months by the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces.
What was your understanding of the Morsi government? Were they as incompetent as claimed? Who did they represent? What did they do in office? What prompted all this discontent?
Well, the Morsi government, of course, in terms of political force, represented the Muslim Brotherhood. But the key point is that he was elected as president not only thanks to those who wanted him as president, but to a large extent, thanks to voters who wanted to prevent the other candidate in the second round, where there were just two of them, from winning. The other candidate being a former general in the army and being seen as a continuation or someone who wants the continuation of the previous regime. So something like almost half of the votes that allowed Morsi to get elected were from people who had not voted for him in the first round. And instead of taking that into consideration and trying, you know, to rule the country in some consensual manner, at the very least to reach out to the other components of the opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood just behaved in the most arrogant manner, trying to infiltrate and take control of all key positions in the state, in the media, in the judiciary. The only component of the state which they could not touch is precisely the army, which has remained and is still the real backbone of the Egyptian state and what people would call there the deep state. But the deep state is above all the army, which is not only the major component of the state in the strict sense, but it's also a major component of the economy, because the army controls close to one-third of the Egyptian economy, and this is not composed of military industries alone, but a lot of civilian industries which are owned by the army. I mean, this is a peculiar kind of public sector belonging to one segment of the state, which is the army. Now, if you want to discuss the social representation, it's another matter.
Yes, that was my next question. Who exactly is the Muslim Brotherhood? Who do they represent? And then who was the base for Morsi's support?
Yeah, well, the Muslim Brotherhood is, I mean, as it is today, I'm not getting into a discussion of its historical evolution, but it's essentially a bourgeois right-wing conservative party with a fundamentalist program, a religious fundamentalist program. The bulk of its political constituency, of its base, is from, let's say, middle classes, petit bourgeois kind of layers, and the leadership has a strong component and very influent of wealthy businessmen, of capitalists, and that's very much the reality of the Muslim Brotherhood. So they represent, in a sense, a section of they came to represent a section of Egyptian capitalism, what I would call the devout. I'm using here, borrowing a formula from a Turkish author, the devout section of the market bourgeoisie. I make a distinction between the market bourgeoisie and the state bourgeoisie. The market bourgeoisie is the one which corresponds more, if you want, to the conception of capitalism based on, you know, free enterprise, market, and the rest. Whereas in countries like Egypt, and many other countries in the region, there's also, I mean, a dominant even section of the bourgeoisie, of capital, which owes its wealth to its connection to the state. And so it's not any mechanism of market which explains this kind of wealth, but rather the political connection of this kind of people. So the Muslim Brotherhood represented the first, that is, well, because they were not part of the state, they were opposed to the existing state, so they were a kind of persecuted component in that regard. This is very much what they represent. And we see this very clearly in the not only continuity, but I would say the fact that on the social economic level, the Morsi government was even more compliant, less critical in its relation with the IMF than even the Mubarak government. I mean, they accepted all the recommendations of the IMF, which were and are really unbelievable. It's really international monetarist fundamentalism that the IMF represents. It's absolutely amazing how after everything you've had, they come with more of the same in their recommendation. Go further in you know, in the neoliberal direction, in austerity policies, in cutting all sorts of subsidies. In this peculiar situation, which Egypt is, with an economic policy which has very deeply failed over the last decades during which it was implemented, and they only ask for more of the same. Their only explanation of what's happening is that it failed because it didn't go far enough in applying our recipes.
That's what they always say. Now, there's a new prime minister whom the New York Times seems to like, who seems even more IMF-friendly, if that's possible. What do you make of this interim regime?
Well, he's not more IMF-friendly, and on the face of it, he's even a member of something called the Social Democratic Party in Egypt. So, but on the issues of social economic policies, there is no qualitative difference between the previous regime, between the Muslim Brotherhood, and between the liberals and the opposition. And the opposition from that point of view is rather a kind of heterogeneous conglomerate of forces, because it includes people who would blame Morsi for not having implemented the recommendations of the IMF. And the fact is that the Morsi government did not implement the conditions put forward by the IMF only because they didn't feel politically strong enough to do that, especially on the eve of elections. They wanted to organize elections. And you have, in the same opposition, you have people like the let's say, represented by the Nasserist candidate who came third in the presidential election, Hamdine Sabahi, who rejects the IMF, the conditions of the IMF, and who had his people demonstrate against the IMF delegation last time it came to Cairo. So the problem is that instead of having a cleavage on the social, economic, on the class issues, what we are seeing since 2011 are cleavages on political issues, even though the real motivation, which is bringing millions of people in the streets, is not political. Neither in 2011 did the people, the millions go in the streets because they were resenting political repression or whatever, nor did they this time go in the streets because they had some problems with the constitution of the Muslim, I mean, that the Muslim Brotherhood enforced or whatever. The truth is that, you know, to mobilize such a huge numbers of people, the only real factor that is leading to this mobilization is their social condition, is the fact that, you know, in the first place, this whole uprising, not only in Egypt, in the whole region, is a result of decades of stalled development, of lack of growth. I described this in details in my just very recently released book, The People Want, and the two first chapters are devoted to discuss the social economic roots of this regional uprising, and one key result of this lack of development was the record rates of unemployment, especially youth unemployment in the region. And this is the real and deep root of these uprisings, of this huge mass mobilization, this huge expressions of popular discontent. That's the key point. But I mean, one can only wish that we will at some point reach, you know, a stage where issues, the real issue fought in the street will be this one, the real one, instead of these kind of confused political situations where you find people hailing the very army that they were demonstrating against just 1 year ago, and people resenting Morsi for policies which most of those who are leading the process now won't change. Actually, they will just continue the same. So that's the real problem in what's happening.
So I presume the army is not going to do much of anything to address the social and economic problems. So
No, I mean, they will try to, when they manage to stabilize things, they will try with the help of the Saudi kingdom and the Emirates, United Arab Emirates, and probably even Qatar will be pushed by the United States to also contribute. They will try to buy some kind of social satisfaction through some measures like, of course, they will very probably raise wages and things of the kind. But, you know, these are measures, very short-lived measures, especially that inflation is increasing, so this won't really solve the problem. And the real problem is unemployment, and for that you need a complete change of tack when it comes to economic policy. The core, as you know very well, Doug, the core of neoliberal thinking is the private sector is the should be the only real engine of the economy. And the fact that this is a completely impossible perspective in a part of the world where private capitalism, the really existing private capitalism, has absolutely no incentive in getting into the kind of investment that you need for a real development. of the country. It is for the most part a capitalism which just seeks a rapid profit, you know, because actually it has no confidence in the future and it doesn't want to go into long term kind of investments. And this is the key reason for the failure of all that, because they move from, you know, years and decades, the 50s and especially the 60s of developmentalism, as we call it, state-centered, with the state playing the main role in development and massive state investment. They move from that since the 70s and 80s into a retreat, a full retreat of the state, with the view that it will be replaced by the private sector if only we create, you know, the freedoms, that we remove the administrative and legal obstacles for the private sector to prosper. And this was a complete failure. It didn't work. And so retreat of the state, not compensated by private sector. So the result is an important reduction, actually, in the rate of investment for over decades, which is a key explanation for this stalled development.
I'm speaking with Gilbert Ashkar, who's a professor of development studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. How involved has the United States been in Egypt recently?
Oh, it has not only recently. It has been, as you know, very, very much involved for now a very long time. And the U.S. is one of the main sources of funding for the Egyptian army. I mean, it contributes an important amount of money every year, but even beyond that, it's a major partner of the Egyptian army in training, in arming, in joint maneuvers, and all that. So there are a lot of synergies and connections. Now, the U.S., this said, the United States, contrary to what some people tend to believe, especially on the left, with sometimes views verging on conspiracy theory, the United States is not an almighty power pulling strings, the strings of everything that happens in the region. It's very far from that, actually. Because the United States is actually at the lowest point in its imperial hegemony in the region since the early 90s, since the first war on Iraq and the massive comeback of U.S. forces in the region. The United States is at its lowest point now, and that is mostly due to the huge defeat for the United States that Iraq was. Iraq is, in some sense, Iraq is more important as a defeat, more severe as a defeat than even the Vietnam War was. I'm not comparing the scale of the wars or and even less so the resistance, definitely not. But I'm speaking of the meaning of both wars when you look at what is and what was at stake. And given the very strategic location of Iraq and the huge importance of the country, that country as an oil producer, that was a huge, major defeat for the U.S. And this combined with a lot of other issues, including the global economic crisis, which started actually in the United States, desynchronization between the crisis of the Western system and the rise of China, and the fact that the Russians recuperated some momentum because of the rise in oil prices, and for nothing else, actually. So all these factors tend to weaken very much the U.S. So in a sense, the unipolar moment, as it was called after 1990, is now behind us. So we are not into a bipolar or whatever, but we are more in a more and more multipolar kind of system in which the United States is still the most powerful, of course, but it is not in a position any longer to really run the game. And this is exactly what, very much so, in the region, not to mention other parts of the world, you can see it very clearly. So when Mubarak faced this huge mass movement, the United States tried to convince him to do to give real concessions. He didn't even listen to them, and they ended up, Washington ended up approving his removal by the military. And after that, Washington decided to bet on the Muslim Brotherhood. The Muslim Brotherhood has been in the 50s and 60s and actually up to the 80s working in alliance with Washington. They were allied with Washington in various respects, especially in the time of Egyptian President Nasser. They were allied with Washington against Nasser, against also any kind of left-wing nationalism in the region, against Soviet influence, communism, etc. And this kind of alliance between Islamic fundamentalism and Washington reached its peak in the Afghanistan War, where the anti-Soviet war, where at the time of the occupation, the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. But this relation ended with the first war on Iraq in 1990-91. The crisis and then the war. Since then, you had a rather tense relation between the Muslim Brotherhood and the United States up to the recent years, where there were some beginnings of change in the attitude of Washington. But what precipitated it very much is the uprising. And since then, Washington decided to bet again, to renew this alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood and bet on them. And in Egypt, it was very clear how Washington was quite rather supportive of Morsi, very mildly criticizing anything he does for fear of, alienating or creating a problem in the relation. They were less critical of Morsi than they had been even of the military when the military were in power, although the military are much closer allies of Washington than whatever the Muslim Brotherhood is. Faced with these events, Washington, was rather embarrassed, as you could see, the Obama administration, because the mobilization against Morsi proved so huge and big that there was no way that they could say, they could ignore that. On the other hand, they were, of course, embarrassed by the coup, because it flies in the face of, all the rhetoric coming out from Washington about democracy, constitution, blah, 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 and all that. Basically, I think what they are now trying to do is mediating, exerting pressure for some kind of compromise between the Muslim Brotherhood and the rest, and the army, and the rest. Washington's trying to push for some kind of large coalition kind of policies in the period ahead.
And finally, we've seen the power of the Egyptian population to displace governments, but are there any forces of the society that can push politics in a seriously different direction, or are we just going to see more of the same?
Well, there is a potential, because if you think of it, you had this absolutely huge mass movement, but when you look at things, you see that this huge thing had been initiated, organized by a group of mostly young people who are clearly left-wing. The Tamarrud movement, rebellion. The Tamarrud movement is issued from Kefaya. There are people who are linked to these circles of Kefaya, which was one of the first protest movements in Egypt in the 2000s. Since the year 2000, and these are rather, they are left-wing, Nasserite kind, left-wing nationalist, progressive kind of people, and this is the kind of circles that organize this huge, absolutely huge mass mobilization. Now you consider another fact. You consider the presidential election in 2012. So you had four candidates that were seen as the leading candidates, the real candidates, and the media would not pay attention to anyone else. And these four guys had huge means. And of course, one of them was Morsi. That was the huge means of the Muslim Brotherhood and funding from Qatar, television support, and all that. The other was the candidate of the military, Shafiq, also with a huge, huge means. There were two other candidates, one from the ancient, from the old regime, and one former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. So let's say liberal wings of both. And what happened is that in the first round of the election, the person who came third came, you know, out of the blue. I mean, someone who nobody expected to come third, and that was Hamdine Sabahi, the Nasserist candidate, with very, very, very modest means, very limited means, ridiculous means compared to the others. It's like having, you know, some kind of, I don't know, Ralph Nader equaling in the votes the two parties in the United States. I mean, this was a huge surprise. So this showed the potential in Egypt. This shows the potential in Egypt. And there are connections between all that. The Nasserites are at the same time in the leadership of the new workers' movement that emerged after the uprising, the new and the independent trade unions and all that. So you have a pool of left-wing progressive forces representing a real potential and a very important potential, because these facts that I'm quoting to you, you won't see them, of course, not in the United States, but not even in Europe, not even, I mean, maybe Greece to a certain extent. So this represents a huge potential on the left. But the key point here is the political leadership, is a strategy which would be a left-wing strategy, is stopping these views at just sticking to alliances with the liberals, with even with the army and the rest, and understanding that you can win hegemony in the society through the social issues, through left-wing politics. Well, until now, the conscience of this is lacking.
That was Gilbert Ashkar, Professor of Development Studies at the School of Oriental and African Studies, University of London. His latest book is The People Want, A Radical Exploration of the Arab Uprising. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Zwischendurch war ich bereit zu staunen, der große Treibstoff zur Rotation. Die eigene Achse, ich drehte mich um und um in meinem taumelnden Mittelpunkt dieses Geschehens. In das es mich hier nun mal verschlagen hatte, in einer Art von trunkenem Universum, das unverantwortlich, leer und sinnfrei rüberkam in Schüben. Altbekannten, grinsenden Wiederholungen, also nicht alles hier war meine Schuld. Wenn in dieser Kälte Schuld überhaupt noch denkbar wäre, jawohl. Selbstporträt.
That was some of Selbstportrait mit Kater, Self-Portrait with a Hangover, by those cut-ups Einstürzen de Neubauten. Next up, Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. Adolf sends out frequent emails and current affairs to a group of his friends. Last week, he wrote up some thoughts on how many older black politicians are getting busted in corruption charges. I thought that it would make excellent radio material, so here he is to talk about that, and, at the end, how poverty came to dominate American discourse about inequality. Adolf Reed. Welcome, Adolf. You were recently reflecting on the fall of a generation of black political leadership to corruption charges. Who are you talking about to start with? But more importantly, what does it mean?
Yeah, I guess the most recent high-profile ones were Jesse Jackson Jr. and his wife, Ray Nagin, the former mayor of New Orleans before him, more names in New York City I can shake a stick at, Kwame Kilpatrick in Detroit, and others. And Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I just thought of another one. In the recent spate, Congressman Bill Jefferson from New Orleans. I mean, these have all been in the last few years. And I mean, there are a couple of things here. One of them is that going back to the late 70s, frankly, corruption arrests among black elected officials have occurred, right? I almost said they've been common. I'm not sure that they had been more common among black elected officials than they were among non-black elected officials. And I mean, the reaction had always been, well, this is part of a conspiracy to bring them down. Even, The Wire kind of implied that in, I think, the third or fourth season about Baltimore. And I don't think there's any question that on some level, especially when Republicans have been in power, the U.S. attorneys have brought charges or initiated or announced investigations that were directed toward smearing the black elected officials. But I think this is something different that's going on now. And I think it's, it's the Democratic Justice Department that's in power now, insofar as the federal investigations go. Well, I mean, two things struck me about the wave of black and I guess to some extent, depending on where you are, also Latino office holders who have gone down in the corruption investigations in the last two or three years. One is that the volume seems to have picked up, right? I mean, there seems to have been more of this, of these exposés than one customarily has encountered. And I realize I haven't done a systematic investigation of this. I'm just going on my gut sense as a political scientist who's been following these people for 40 years. So that's one thing. But the other thing that struck me is how penny ante the thefts have been. I think Nagin is going to jail over something like a $5,000 kickback, and many of the others are just kind of small potato stuff. And that just got me reflecting on this. I guess the way that I put it, sort of the shorthand, which is going to seem cruder than it probably should be, in my comment on it, was that it just feels a little bit like one of these moments where the ruling class has decided that they'd function better with a different kind of black public or of POC public functionary, and what that sparked, or what partly sparked that thought is, you may remember in 2008, in the summer of 2008, a few months before the election, Matt Bai, who always brings together the mind how stupid, or I mean the question how stupid and shallow can a journalist possibly be, but Matt Bai did this piece in the Time Sunday magazine, the title of which I think was, "Is Obama the Death of Black Politics or the End of Black Politics or something like that?" And the bulk of it was insipid and wrongheaded and was generational and all other kind of dumb stuff. But the one observation that I thought was interesting was that Bai said that drawing the contrast, he said that James Clyburn and what he described as the civil rights generation of black officials, where they had seen themselves as representatives from the black community, Obama, Booker, Fenty, et cetera, saw themselves as representatives to the black community. And I thought that was a really interesting and a revealing observation. Of course, saying from whom was beyond Bai's ken. But I think that kind of nails it, right? Because I think a problem from the standpoint, and look, I mean, it's not, I'm not being nostalgic about the earlier cohorts of black elected officials. I mean, I worked for a black mayor of a big city, after all. I understand these, what they are and aren't, and what they've stood for and haven't. But the earlier strains of them were, and I think remain, somewhat more likely to have come up through networks that had made them beholden to some degree, at least to pay attention to pressure from public sector unions and other groups or tendencies that are linked organically to mobilized groups of voters. And the nice thing about anti-democratic neoliberalism is that, and I mean nice from their point of view, is that they really want to get all that kind of representative government stuff out of the way, and depend on public officials who give the advantages of what Hannah Pitkin called descriptive representation. That is to say, they can claim to represent an ascriptively defined population of which they are at least nominally a part, or to put it more crudely, people who look like them, but without any of the history of accountability to representative bodies that have connections to those constituencies as voters. And Fenty, and I'll be quiet after this, but Fenty, as I said in my comment, kind of stands out in the sense that he basically gave up his mayoralty. He was a one-term mayor of D.C., and what he did in his one term was appoint Michelle Rhee. Oh, yeah, I forgot to say odious. I always like to say that in front of her name. But he appointed Michelle Rhee, school superintendent, and her history so inflamed the black electorate against her that it was clear months before the election, just counting the numbers, that if he didn't toss her overboard, he would lose. And he refused to toss her overboard, and he lost. Now, I'm not crying any tears for Adrian Fenty. Not least because I just learned that he's fallen into sinecures at a couple of venture capital firms, so he's doing okay. But that's just an illustration.
Okay, so the older generation, let's say their modal career path was through civil rights struggle or classic big city politics or something like that. The new generation, what's their modal career path?
From what I'm increasingly seeing as the Sandhurst or the School of the Americas for the domestic urban management core, they went through Ivy League institutions or the functional equivalent, thereof. And I guess they've taken that route, right, linked through public service or the foundation world and connections to Wall Street. And I think that's where the sources of the campaign funding and stuff come from.
Because we see Bill Thompson running for mayor of New York City did a stint at a municipal bond firm, so he even had that passage.
I mean, you have to understand, right? I mean, how better to understand what the city needs to do than to work for a bond firm? Although it used to be that's what they do after they left, right? That's what Maynard Jackson did after he left office or between his two stints as mayor. That's what Carol Moseley Braun did after she left the Senate. And in fact, if you look at her voting record, while she was really very good on the welfare reform stuff, like everything else she did seemed at least cognizant of the likelihood that that's what her post-Senate career was going to look like. And, being close to being kind of a protege of Simon, Paul Simon didn't hurt much.
So this career template, you can apply it to the man at the top, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And look, I mean, what I find interesting about this, too, is that going back to when Carl Stokes was elected the first black mayor of Cleveland, I just learned or I was reminded, I can't remember which now, a few months ago, that in Stokes's memoir, he identifies Robert Dahls, who governs, as having been instrumental in helping him to consider the possibility that he could actually run for mayor of Cleveland, because ethnic pluralism and the narratives of ethnic succession seemed to fit what was happening in big cities at that point. But in addition to that, four Foundation-funded voter registration drives were important, I think, or partly Ford Foundation-funded, in creating the kind of electoral mobilization that brought him to office, Ken Gibson, who was the first black mayor of Newark, and others as well. And the Ford leadership development program in the late 60s and the early 70s, also kind of, it wasn't just blacks or Latinos, but whites as well. Actually, a friend of mine from college was a white guy who had gone through the leadership development program at Ford too. But Ford took an active role in creating, right, a common sense or in cultivating a common sense among a cohort of rising or emerging or proto or potential public functionaries, right, in the late 60s and the early 70s. And, one of the things that sort of flat-footed mainstream political science is really good for is that Albert Carnegie and Susan Welch's examination of black urban elected officials, mayors and council members. This book came out in the early 80s, I believe, 1980 maybe. Looked at their backgrounds and found that in addition to the civil rights route, what was even more prominent was a prior history in your community action agencies and especially in the Model Cities program. There are a couple of different ways you can look at this, right? I mean, one is kind of innocent. It's that, well, of course, people who are drawn to public service in that one domain would wind up pursuing the options that became available in the electoral realm as they did, right, over the 70s. And that's certainly true. Of course, the other side of it is also true, right? The less innocent picture on the phenomenon is also true. It's that, those institutions helped to cultivate and implant a common sense that the net effect of which was that just about the only thing that changed in the trajectory and the priorities of urban governance over the 1970s was the melanin content at the top.
And I'm remembering correctly that Obama's mother worked for Ford, didn't she?
Yes, she did. That's right. I forgot about that. Yep.
It is no accident, as the vulgar marches. I'm speaking with Adolf Reed, professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. This new crop of politicians, unlike the previous one claimed to be speaking for the black community in some sense, and now they're speaking too, but is anybody listening?
Well, see, that's the other thing. I'd say again, right, I mean, the answer is anecdotal, or at least my answer is anecdotal, which is that the black PMC is listening very attentively. I'm on an email group of former UNC and Duke students, largely people from my own era, but some younger ones. And what that means is that most of these people are successful sort of late career, or in some cases even the retired corporate and government functionaries. And there's kind of a two-line struggle on this group about Obama. And the two of us, or two and a half of us, I think, probably, who make up the skeptical side, of course, are completely overwhelmed by a line that my fellow leftist on this group has often said seems like it comes straight from the White House press office, that whatever Obama does is correct. Whatever criticisms have been made of him are haters or racist or self-hating or naive we don't even have to delve into my little email group. Just the reaction of the POCs on MSNBC, which of course is a White House outlet, but to the Snowden case. I mean, I was stunned to see Joy-Ann Reid from GRIO, for instance, who's pinch hitting for Alice Wagner, who herself has nothing to write home about either, going after a guy from the WikiLeaks in a way. I mean, I'm old enough to remember the McCarthy hearings, and that's what this was like. I mean, who's funding Snowden? Aren't you paying for his lawyers? And then this bizarre line that's formed among them that, the issue isn't Snowden's civil disobedience, it's his refusal to face the music, right? So that somehow makes him less justified as a whistleblower because he's not prepared, to be tossed or to be buried someplace in the prison system like what's happened to Bradley Manning. I mean,
40 to life and sensory deprivation.
Right. Right, exactly. So I think that's an illustration. And look, I mean, people like us say this all the time, and we said it about Clinton just as much as we're saying it about Obama. But it's hard to imagine a Republican, or I guess maybe it might be different if we're a black Republican, I don't know. But it's hard to imagine a Republican being able to get away with half the stuff that Obama, a tenth of the stuff that Obama has been able to get away with without... without outrage, right, from the internet fundraising left, right? I mean, just off the top of my head, right? I mean, the killing of the 10-year-old in a drone strike in Yemen, right, which is someplace we're not even supposed to be, right, even by our own standards. gets not a peep. I mean, so in that sense, insofar as the larger cultural victory of a kind of anti-racism as a public ideology kind of tends to short-circuit critical responses from the left to actions taken by neoliberals who are either women, gay, or POCs, I suspect is part of the value of people like Booker and Obama and, Fenty and the more more of those who are popping up now. I just happened to see this putz, what's his name? Perry from Hartford, right? The charter school pimp who has been on, who I guess had a contract as an education expert for CNN for a number of years, and I saw he was on MSNBC Sunday. No background in education, no experience, no history, no practice, no deep thought. He's just a guy who's got a personal story about having been raised in Middletown in poverty by a single mother, and that's what qualifies him to be in the vanguard of the destruction of public education in America. So it all works out.
Well, by that reasoning, I should have a professorship in Italian somewhere because my mother's family, came from Italy and spoke Italian.
Totally.
We're just about out of time, but in a few minutes left, we were talking before I pressed the record button about the growth of or the emergence of poverty as the central discourse around economic distribution in the U.S., and you've been doing some research on that. So what have you been finding?
Well, as I warned you, right, I'm not sure how coherent this is going to be because my head has been buried in it. But the question that I put was, why did poverty, condense as a way of talking about inequality in the early 60s? And digging around in the decade or the two decades of debate within economic policy, at the national level, after the defeat of the full employment bill in 1945, in addition to seeing the emergence of a business-friendly version of Keynesianism that basically disconnected the social from the economic. Already by the mid-50s, since unemployment rose almost immediately after the Korean War and hardly ever, I think only like 6 months out of 130, fell below 4%, which had been the norm promised by in utopian growth liberal politics, right? That growth would raise all boats and so forth and so on. Even the Eisenhower administration showed concern about unemployment rates that were too high and were persistently too high, and what they considered to be a residual low income population. And I guess the long and short of it is that part of the concession, and this is way too facile a shorthand, that emerged over the post-war reflective of the victory of this conservative Keynesianism was, it's kind of like the gag rule with respect to slavery in the 1830s, right? It was improper to talk about inequality. So how do you handle concern that unemployment rates are too high and aren't coming down, and way too many people are poor or are deprived in Leon Kaiserling's somewhat more expansive understanding of inequality. And long story short, poverty emerges as a way to talk about this problem that's disconnected from the structures of inequality that are intrinsic to capitalist economic and social reproduction. And then what happens then is that poverty, of course, since human capital discourse is available by the early 60s, and cultural essentialism racial essentialism under the label of culture hadn't ever really gone away. The last ditch moment of a struggle for of the assertion of a social democratic approach to fighting inequality, as Judith Stein argues, took shape between 1963 and 64. The long and short of it is that the social democratic push lost and the culture of poverty push won. And I mean, the irony of all this is, right, that the community action approach, and this goes back to the Piven and Cloward thing, seemed to most people like it was the radical one, because it was the activistist one, if I can permitted that anachronistic use. But the reality was it was just the opposite.
Well, this is interesting because, you sit around the NGO philanthropic world these days and you can hear almost exclusively about low-income communities of color, which by my back-of-the-envelope calculations are about 7% of the U.S. population. The middle 60 or 70 disappears from this discourse, and their welfare and power and security just are not of interest. It's just the worst-off, most marginalized 7% that are the interest of program officers.
Well, that's not surprising, And I mean, the solution is kind of always the same, isn't it? It's like some version of therapy and taking them bags of groceries. And then you can put the two together by having them grow the groceries.
That's the Alice Waters approach.
Right? Right.
Some of the folks in Berkeley might not like to hear that. But she runs a very fine restaurant, but I'm not sure it's great social policy.
I couldn't agree with you more, like on either count.
I was Adolf Reed, a professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some more from those rollicking good old boys, Einstürzen und Neubauten. This, a bit of Perpetuum Mobile. Till next week, bye.
Ich bin unterwegs mit meiner unsichtbaren Eismaschine. Mit meinem unsichtbaren offenen Kamin. Sie sitzen neben mir im Flugzeug. Sie liegen neben mir in meinem Hotel Kingsize Bett. Sie zählen nicht als Excess Luggage. Sie brauchen keinen Wake-up-Call.